For more presentations like this, visit www.xenos.org.
All right, so we are in a significant transition phase in our study of the Gospel of Luke. Through chapter 9, verse 45, basically, it has been an introduction to Jesus Christ, who he is, the relationship of Jesus as Messiah to the Old Testament prophetic voice, and the demonstration through his actions that he is indeed the long-awaited Messiah. And so he has done this repeatedly through the course of his very popular public ministry at this point. He's declared who he is, but in ways that are gathering suspicion, because he's not the conquering king that the popular people want. And he's saying things kind of under the radar screen that have become a bit offensive to the religious mindset. And so you have this incredible crescendo to this whole setting at the Mount of Transfiguration, where we talked about this last week. After Peter makes this great confession of Christ, "You're the Christ of God, you're the Messiah of God," they are taken up to the mountain and are shown something pretty amazing, which is namely that Moses and Elijah and the voice of God itself affirms that Jesus is the Messiah. Pretty incredible. The rest of Luke's narrative goes from this high place, the mountain, to the north, height of popularity, slowly south, south towards Jerusalem, south toward controversy, south toward betrayal, south to the cross. And that is where it's all going. And in this middle section of Luke's gospel, from chapter 9 through the beginning of chapter 19, the focus is really on these lessons in discipleship. What does it mean to be a follower of Jesus Christ? And so Jesus is going to begin that conversation in the passage that we're studying here this evening. And we're going to see that over the next 10 chapters, that in one way or another, everything that Jesus says and does winds its way right back around to the disciples in answer to this question: what does it mean and what does it look like to be a follower of mine? So tonight we're talking about the first lesson in discipleship. This comes from starting in verse 46. He says, "An argument started among them," that is the disciples, "as to which of them might be the greatest." So there you have the setting. "And Jesus, knowing that they were what they were thinking in their hearts, took a child and stood by his side and said to him, 'Whoever receives this child in my name receives me, and whoever receives me receives him who sent me. For the one who is least among you, this is the one who is great.'" So here's the question that they're asking among each other. And you can imagine these 12 guys, and they've been strutting around with Jesus now for maybe as many as 3 years at this point, or close to it. And they all have their credentials. You've got Peter, who seems to be the voice of them all. You got John, who's saying, "Well, he loves me most." You've got all these other disciples who are weighing in with their varying credentials, and they're all saying, which one of them is the greatest? And of course, there's a lot at stake here, because when Jesus comes, as they were conceiving, to go down to Jerusalem and to establish his kingdom on the earth, the greatest one would be the one who would have the greatest amount of authority over this kingdom that Jesus is establishing. And this is actually a debate. We see the introduction of it here. This is exactly the same debate that goes all the way down to the last night of Christ's life, where they're again sitting around discussing with one another who would be the greatest. And so in that way, this controversy sort of bookends this whole section on the call to discipleship. So let's look at Jesus' reaction and kind of unpack what is at stake here. The issue, of course, is humility. And so in answer to the question, who is the greatest, Jesus, knowing what's going on in their heads, is just going to basically put them in their place. It's all about humility. He says, "Whoever receives this child in my name receives me." And so he points to this child and says, that's the model we're looking for here. And which could be a little bit of a misunderstanding about this, actually. What is he talking about? What is it about a child that sort of is looked at by Jesus right here as an example of the heart of a disciple. Well, I think it's not that a child is ignorant of a lot of things or that they're particularly innocent. That's not the point. What is the point, though, is that a child has an utter lack of pretense and pride. When a child wants something, a child goes after it. And you see, for instance, I mean, I'm certain this never happens in this building, but I'm told that it happens in other places where children gather, where one child has something and another child wants it, and what does the child who wants it do? Well, they go over, they make their case, they argue, they plead, and then if they don't get their way, they in peace walk away, right? Or not. A child who knows what they want goes and demands it, and if they don't get it, they steal it, they take it. There's no pretense. It's what you see is what you get. And pride? Children, oddly enough, here's the weird thing. Have you ever offered something that a child wanted and had them say to you, "Oh, I don't know. I'm not sure that I've earned that," or "it's not clear to me that it would be appropriate for me to take this from you at this time"? A kid that offered a sucker is going to say, "Psh, thanks." They're going to take it. And that's why, because that's the way kids are. It's older, when we get older, that we start thinking about our ego and ourself and the thought that taking something from somebody who's offering it to me might kind of reveal that I'm needy or something like that. And so our pride kicks in and we become less interested in that way. And it's those kinds of things that Jesus has in mind when he says, you know, here's your example. Be like this child. Because the people who receive a child in my name receive the one who sent me. That's the paradigm that we're looking for. It's just that absence of pride, that absence of pretense, that just what you see is what you get kind of thing, which is so different and such a contrast to this jockeying for position and this arguing over which one of them is the greatest. But it launches a section in Luke's gospel that we want to explore tonight on this issue of humility. Humility is the first lesson in discipleship. And let's just kind of work it out here this evening. First, thinking about what humility is not. What is humility not? What are we not talking about here? We're not saying that a person who's humble thinks less of themselves. We're not saying that a person who is humble has a low self-image, low self-esteem. They think themselves to be, you know, inferior in that sense. The issue with humility is not that we think less of ourselves. It is that we think of ourselves less. That's the difference. So it's not a self-loathing that is humility. In fact, I would argue, that we don't have time for it here, that people who are deeply immersed in self-loathing are among the most prideful people I've ever met. When we talk about humility, we're not talking about a childlike lack of sophisticated understanding. He's not saying what was really admirable about the child is that they're largely ignorant. That's not the quality that really is coming out here. And the reality is that if we want to develop humility, that will come often in proportion to the depth of our understanding about the person of God and the insight that God gives us about ourselves. So a lack of sophisticated understanding is definitely not what we're talking about with humility. Or thirdly, an overinflated view of other people. You might say, well, you know, I'm really humble because I just realized that everyone else in my life is just greater than me in every way. And so you have this kind of idealized view of other people. And that's not okay either. And I think sometimes, I see this sometimes in parents who have idealized view of their children. I talked to a friend, this has been a number of years ago now, and we were talking about, he was not a Christian, and he was exploring Christianity, and he said to me at a point, he said, you know, the thing is, I just realized I don't need God because I have my children. And I'm like, what do you mean by that? He said, well, they serve as the objects of my worship. And I'm like, really? It was the most transparent thing I had ever heard in my life in this area. But it really explains a lot about the fact that here's a person who was willing to just drop everything to be involved in every facet of his children's lives, their sporting events, their school events, their, everything that they were involved with. This person just was absolutely locked on in that way. And while this guy said it in terms that I just, that were so straightforward, it's amazing. I think that undercurrent is also part of educated upper middle class American culture with respect to our children. I think that attitude is there oftentimes, and that where what really matters is that we, that our children become this great reflection of ourselves, and that if they're succeeding, then we're okay, that we mean something. That's not what we mean by humility either. Let's take a closer look. What is humility? Why humility? Those are the two questions we want to interact with. The first one here, why humility, begins, of course, with the person of Christ. That if we're going to be a follower of Jesus Christ, we want to follow that which is most characteristic of who he is. And humility is at the core of who Christ is. Look what Paul says in Philippians 2, verses 5 to 8. He says, although he existed in the form of God, so Christ existing in eternal connection with his Father as God, but it says he did not regard equality with God a thing to be held on to, but he emptied himself. That's where the humility comes in. And he humbled himself by becoming obedient to the point of death, even death on a cross. Why do we value humility as the first principle of discipleship? Because that's what Christ did. That's why. That the, if we are going to really follow him, if our lives are going to matter for the purposes of Christ in the world, it is that we are like him in this very important regard. The good news about Jesus Christ is that he in him is the visitation of God among us. That's really just a remarkable passage. We're going to look at Philippians 2 in three different ways here. This is the first of the three here this evening. Here is God existing eternally as Father, Son, and Holy Spirit. And beholding the condition of the human race, of God's creation that is so broken, the Son decides, with the plan of the Father, to set aside everything that is his, all of his prerogatives, to enter into the human experience, to humble himself to a place where he puts himself at the mercy of a rebellious creation, at the mercy of a creation who, if given the opportunity, would kill even God himself, which is what they do in Christ. But why does he allow himself to do this? Why the humility? Because through his death, he takes upon himself the burden and the penalty for all our guilt. And so, remarkably, the most vicious act of defiance that humanity has against God, putting his own son to death, actually ends up being that very thing through which God is reaching out to human beings, to people like you and me, to some of us here tonight who are here because we do bear the weight of a sense of distance from God, a sense of I'm not right within and I know I'm not right with God. And the answer to that problem is right here. It is in the cross of Jesus Christ, and where he's calling on you to exercise humility and to receive a gift that you cannot earn, and which is simply to open your heart to the open hands of faith, saying, will you be merciful to me as I recognize my utter inadequacy before you, and to trust that what Christ has done on our behalf in the cross is sufficient to deal with that barrier that separates ourselves from God. That's the biblical message. And that's why it has to start here. It has to start with this most fundamental thing about Christ and what he has done for us. Christ's humility is the basis for our humility. And then two, there is just a real danger of pride as a Christ follower. And there are two little narrative pieces that illustrate what this means. He goes on to talk about the competitiveness that always arises out of this discussion of which one is the greatest. And so it says in verse 49 that John, answered and said, Master, we saw someone casting out demons in your name, and we tried to prevent him because he doesn't follow along with us. We can't have competitors here. This has to be our thing, right? He's forgetting that, yes, there are 12 disciples, but Jesus had already sent out 70 others as well, and they're out representing Christ in different ways. And Jesus says, look, don't hinder this person, for he who is not against you is for you. And so it's just the idea here that we don't want to have competitive linkages between people who are trying to do the things of God. That's not the issue at all. Now, in Luke 11, in a couple of chapters, he's going to say something that looks a little different than that, where he says, he who is not for me is against me. And so what does that mean in relation to this point here, where he says, he who is not against you is for you? The difference is the word me. And he says, if you're not for me, then by virtue of not joining in, then you stand outside. But for the disciples, he's saying, look, if other people in my name are doing things that I've called a number of people to do, let them go. If they're not against you, then they're your ally in that sense. And that should be the kind of spirit that governs the way real believing Christians relate to one another and to other kinds of groups. We should be glad, for instance, that there are many churches in this city that maybe many of us would not feel necessarily all that comfortable in being a part of, for mostly social, cultural kinds of reasons. But we're glad that they do the kind of work that they do, because they're able to reach a strata of culture that we cannot, and that is good. Paul describes this in his letter to the Philippians. He says, some, in this controversy that was brewing in Philippi, in that city, says some are preaching Christ from envy and strife. They're jockeying for position. They're claiming to be greater than Paul. He says some from selfish ambition rather than pure motives. And so what do we do about that? These people who have questionable motives. He says, well, what then? Only that in every way, whether in pretense, that is by deception in some ways, or in truth, he says, at least Christ is proclaimed, and I'll rejoice in that. And so I think that there's kind of an interesting little message here for us, that we really take seriously the calling of other groups that are representing Christ in different ways in this city and in other places as well, and not in some competitive way express the thought that we're somehow better, we're somehow more in tune with God or with what he's doing in the world. That's not our call to make. It's God and he alone who will say to his servants, well done, good and faithful servants. It's not for us to judge or to compete or to say that somehow we're better. Oh, on the issue of judging, the narrative goes on. He says to the disciples, they have a controversy. He says, when the days were approaching for his ascension, he determined to go to Jerusalem. Okay, that's part of the narrative we're talking about here. It says, he sent messengers on ahead, and they entered a village of the Samaritans to make arrangements for Jesus. The Samaritans were half Jews, and they're like right in the northern part of Israel, kind of north central. There's Israel above, there's Judah down below, but it's all one country. Any self-respecting Jewish teacher would just simply go around the Samaritan area because they were viewed to be heretical, and of course they were. And the further inference, which is not true, which is that God's not interested in these people because of what they believe. So that's the kind of the background thing. It says that he sent messengers ahead. They entered the village of the Samaritans to make arrangements, but the villagers did not receive him because he was traveling to Jerusalem. They're like, now, you're okay if you come to our territory, but if you're on your way to Jerusalem, those are our enemies. Those are the people that we are in enmity with, and if that's where you're going, then you're really not welcome here. And so when his disciples, James and John, saw this, they said to Jesus, they said, Lord, do you want us to command fire to come down from heaven and consume them? How dare they? You know, this kind of thing. I think that's hilarious. I mean, it just cracks me up to think about the scene here. Oh, you've been slighted, Jesus. Now it's time to smote, you know, or smite, or whatever the verb is. I don't know what it is. oh, we got a real pickle on our hands now. We got these people who are rejecting Jesus. That's not okay. And then you got his disciples calling for, you know, the lightning bolt treatment. What are we going to do here? Well, Jesus says, he turned to them and he rebuked them. And then they went to another village. No, we're not going to smote them, or slay them in any way. We're going to realize that here is a group of people who are living in darkness. They're far from God. And it's not the intent of God to enter into judgment with these people. It's not the right time for that. There's good news. And there, it's interesting how in all four of the Gospels, the interaction with Jesus among the Samaritans, and we'll talk about the Good Samaritan next week, a love of God for people who are far from him. That's what that whole thing is about. The irony in the scriptures and in the teaching of Jesus, the people who recognize that they're the furthest from God are in fact the closest to God. And the people who think that they're right in there with God because they're so good, these are the ones who are really the furthest away. Why? Because they lack the humility to see their problem before God. That's the problem. So there you go. There's that. The most emphasized of all Jesus' teaching on discipleship is humility. I've just done a few verses up there. I went through my concordance this morning. There are about 25 very specific verses in the Gospels where Jesus is instructing his disciples to cultivate humility, the heart of a servant, and so forth. So he who exalts himself will be humbled, but the one who humbles himself will be exalted. The one who is greatest among you is he that serves. If I, the Lord, wash your feet, you ought to wash one another's. And the list is just very long. This is really the heart of the thing, to cultivate this deep humility before God that enables us also to be humble before one another. So what does that mean? What does it look like? That's what we want to explore here in just the time that we have. I want to talk about three aspects of humility and what it means then to become humble in that way. Let's think about this together. The first point is that humility is an inner awareness of God's incredible generosity toward you. That is to say that we stand before God not on the basis of our credentials, but on the basis of his mercy. That he's just that good. That he loves us that much, that while we are utterly unworthy, he lavishes upon us his love and his acceptance in Jesus Christ. And that is the foundation for all real humility. It's where do I stand before the God of the universe? I love the way Paul puts it as he's describing it to his buddy Timothy in 1 Timothy 1. He says it's a trustworthy statement deserving full acceptance that Christ Jesus came into the world to save sinners, he says, among whom I am foremost of all. Yet for this reason I found mercy, so that in me as the foremost, Jesus Christ might demonstrate his perfect patience as an example to those who would believe in him. Can you say that with Paul? I know of no one in my life who is more sinful than me. Or are you lacking the humility like the disciples to say, well, at least I'm not like Derek. I mean, really? I mean, Molly, you've got to be kidding, you know? And have that kind of comparative view that basically is trying to say, I may be a little bent, but I'm not that bad. And really, the only way that we get at a deep understanding, a transforming experience and awareness of the grace of God is to say like Paul, man, I live inside my own skin, and there's nobody who looks outside from the outside to me that looks worse than what I perceive inside. And that's not morbid introspection. He's not just focusing on why he sucks or something like that. He's just as deeply aware that who God is and who he is are so vastly different that if there is any way to be connected to that God, it has to be 100% on the basis of what God does and not on the credentials that I bring to the table. Are you trying to meet God halfway? Are you trying to say, God, I'm doing my best, and now I expect for you to bless my life, or something like that? Driven by those kinds of expectations that presume that you deserve something when grace says you deserve nothing. That's where the real base of humility comes in, when we are amazed by the generosity of God towards us. And so if that is the platform that we're standing on, if that's what humility at its core means, what does it look like to become humble? It means to have a gracious outlook and an attitude towards others, and to relate to them without love demands. That's what humility would mean, to be gracious and to stand apart from love demands. To be gracious. Andrew Murray has written a book about 100 years ago called Humility. I highly recommend it. It's very humbling. And he says, think about the implications of this for your life. There's almost nothing, he says, harder to bear than injustice from others. Oh man, can you just remember with vivid clarity the thing that person said and just how demeaning that was? The betrayal that you felt when that person did that thing to you. And all those things which are real and which are wrong and which are super hurtful. And he says there is a sense of humiliation and the consciousness of our rights. When we're treated wrongly, we sense, man, that's just not right. We say to ourselves, you owe me. And that becomes then the kind of the what works into our heart, and a rift exists then between ourselves and that other person. And he says, in what our fellow creatures do to us, it is not easy to recognize the will of God, who thus allows us to be tried to see if we have truly taken Christ as our example. Ow. What is Murray saying? He's saying God doesn't cause these injustices that occur in our life, but neither does he prevent them from coming into our lives, and he intends to use even those painful and difficult experiences of being mistreated by others for the purpose of drawing us nearer to the heart of God, to understand in a deeper way than we have ever felt before the broken heart of God in the face of the injustices of humanity and the cost that that brought to him in his own death on the cross. And so if we are going to truly represent Christ to a broken world, then we must learn to embrace and to experience the brokenness of that world in a Christ-like way. The Christian who is offended by the sins of others cannot represent a God who reaches out in grace and in mercy. The person who says, you've hurt me, and that's the end of the relationship, cannot be that agent of reconciliation between humanity and God. It is only when we are able to stand in there like our Lord, to follow him in his rejection, in his suffering, that we are enabled then to, in a authentic way, in a personally persuasive way, to really represent who he is. If we are protecting ourselves from the real or perceived danger of injustice inflicted upon us by other people, we cannot represent Jesus Christ with real persuasive power. You can express the message of Christ, absolutely. But to have that sense of reality about what we're saying, it really requires this element right here. And many of us draw the line at just this point, and we say, I will move toward a person relationally only insofar as it remains safe for me. Where there is no risk of being harmed by them, being wronged by them in any way, because that for me is a deal breaker. And that is a very legalistic, it's a religious way of viewing our relationships. It has nothing to do with the grace of God. Second, along these lines, part of our ability to cultivate this deep aspect of humility is to give without love demands. How do you know when you think people owe you? No one would say, I won't say that. Most people know enough to not say people owe me. Because we're not supposed to think that way. But you know what? We do. People often are very aware of just how much they serve. Oh, yeah. I just serve so much. And what does that mean? That means that I'm out there, I'm really sacrificing, and because I'm doing that, if people don't recognize this, if I'm not appreciated for the wonderful things that I'm doing, then I'm very disappointed. I find it kind of resentful then to be called on to serve other people. This is what we could maybe refer to as spiritual infantilism. It's just the idea that I don't mind serving as long as I get the strokes. As long as people recognize me and recognize what I've done and really appreciate that, then that's good. But if that doesn't happen, then I find myself at this place. It's like, well, why should I serve? There is a bell that goes off in some people's heads, in many people's heads, in all people's heads at some time, when confronted by the call of their friends to real sacrificial service to others, to have that sort of sense of resentment, like, why should I? You know, what have they done for me or whatever? And when we're in that place, that is an arrogant place. That's a place that puts us above the attitude of Christ, who set aside all of his rights, as we talked about earlier, to enter into this world to meet that most pressing need, even if people don't respond. That's humility in practice. Second, humility involves a self-giving lifestyle. It's a way of living. It's not just their humble actions here or there. It's just that my whole outlook, my demeanor, my life plan, my agenda reflects this kind of humility. That's what we're describing here. So Paul says, going back to our Philippians passage that talked about Christ's humility, Paul immediately addresses that to these Philippians, and he says, hey, don't do anything from selfishness or empty conceit, but with humility of mind. Regard one another as more important than yourselves. Have this attitude in you, which was also in Christ. The humility of mind to regard others' needs as more important than your own. And that's a lens that we look at our relationships through. And we say to ourselves, Jesus was humble and set aside his rights and entered into relationship. And so with a humble mind, I'm going to be in that same place, looking for what are the opportunities to meet the real pressing needs around me. What are the needs? Are we even aware of what the deep needs of people in our life actually are? You say, well, I think that they're getting along just fine. Really? I guarantee you, they don't think so. And so just this ability to have that humble outlook that regards other people as more important than self gives us that perception, that ability to sense what the real needs of the moment are. We find ourselves listening a little bit more sensitively. We find ourselves praying for people a little more urgently. And these are the things that kind of are about a lifestyle, an agenda of a life that's humble. What does it look like in concrete practice? It means to commit to put other people's needs ahead of ourselves. And I'm just saying here, it's not a sentiment. Oh, yeah, I just think it's real important that we're sacrificial as you go on and just do your own thing. Real humility gives rise to concrete commitments to put someone else first. Back to Philippians 2, he says, if there's any encouragement, of course, these are all things that we desperately want and need. If there's any encouragement in Christ, if there's any consolation of love, you know, those relationships that are rooted in something where I can actually trust you because you love in this self-sacrificial way. If there's any fellowship of the Spirit, that ability to come together and we're all of one mind and we're serving Christ together, and there's just that a sense of, man, God's with us. He's present. If there's any affection and compassion, we were designed to need these things. We were designed to need these things. But these are only things that occur in relationship. That's what's true of all of these things. Encouragement, love, fellowship, affection, compassion. These are all relational things. And so he says, make my joy complete by being, he says, of the same mind with one another. In other words, to have the humility to say, it doesn't have to all be my way, on my time, you know, the way I want it to be. To be of the same mind is to listen to the minds of others, to find places to connect, the common ground, the ability to defer to the interests of the other or the consensus of the majority or whatever it is. And this is really that place where our pride sometimes is really evident, where it's like, no, I know the way and I know what I want. And we're unable to come to a same mind as others. And for that reason, then, all these cool things that we just described, the encouragement, the love, the fellowship of the Spirit, and affection, compassion, we just don't experience those things anymore because we're really on the outside. He says, maintaining the same love. Yeah, the humble man is the one who says, I will sacrifice self-interest for the sake of your good. Concretely, in relationship, these are people I know. And they matter to me because they matter to God. And I believe that He's placed me in their life for the purposes of His work through me to them. And so I'm willing to elevate their need and to serve them. United in spirit. It's that sweet kind of agreement and intent on one purpose. That unity of purpose that drives a group of people forward. These are the things that make community life possible. They're the things that make community life genuinely transformative. And they all are rooted, as Paul says in this passage, in humility. We have to have that humility. And then lastly, I think this is something that we just need to end with. It's a really, I think, an important aspect of this whole thing. The humility is being yielded to God. And what am I meaning here? Let's think of it first diagnostically. Do you experience a lack of peace and joy in your Christian life? A sense that there's something just sort of beyond the horizon about God. Something that is, you're convinced, you know, that this is true, but it's not really gripping your heart. You're finding that you kind of walk through the motions without a whole lot of real sense of connection to the thing. And that to you, the things of God are kind of like a lot of effort, and there are other things that become increasingly interesting and more motivating to you in the area of your careers or your families or things like this. And so you just, like most of Christendom, you just sort of go through the show up when you're supposed to show up, say the things you're supposed to say, and then you go on with your life. That's largely Christianity in our culture, and it creeps into our fellowship as well. It creeps into each of our hearts where we feel that sense of just there's a distance between me and God, a sense that there's nothing really at stake. There's a lack of urgency in the things of God. And so that it becomes one of many priorities. Do you know what I'm talking about? Is this just me? You know what I'm saying? Yeah. What's the problem here? Has God changed? No, God has not changed. Has the truth about God changed? No, the truth about God has not changed. Has the agenda of God for my life or through me to the world changed? No, that has not changed. But something within me is lacking. And it is this that is the real ticket to the difference between a kind of a Christian belief versus a real robust, transformative, satisfying Christian experience, Christian life. And it is this word, surrender. And it is this that Jesus is calling his disciples to in humility. To give up their agenda. To set it all aside to come follow me, he says. Let the spiritually dead bury their own, but you come and follow, he goes on to say in the same chapter. It's yielding all that I have to God, and to say it's all yours. That is where we begin to experience something very unique and very powerful in the Christian life. It is that's where we find that I'm at peace because I'm no longer in a tug of war over the direction and the control of my life, but I've yielded it to God. I've said, you lead. I'll surrender. I'll yield. You lead. I'll submit my agenda to your purview and for your editing and for your moving me a different way. I will do that. I will surrender to you. Well, that's a very conscious decision that Christians must make to cultivate this kind of humility. It's not natural. What's the natural thing is to go our own way, to do our own thing, right? I mean, we are, after all, self-reliant, self-interested Americans. We are all this way. It's bred into our DNA. And Jesus says, okay, but now you set that aside. You surrender your rights to your life to me. And I lead. Now, I want to be very clear. This has nothing to do with becoming a Christian. We become a Christian on the basis of God's grace and God's grace alone. We just respond to this offer to receive his forgiveness. We bring nothing to that transaction. And that is satisfying to God. And that's beautiful. We become reconciled to him in that one moment. But if we want to follow him, then we're into surrender. Then we're into setting aside our prerogatives. To put aside this tug of war between what God is calling us to and what I want, my beautiful plan for my own life. And when we are able to do that, we experience a sense of joy in that. A joy that at this point then, God is accomplishing his beautiful, good purpose in me and through me. And having made a decision like this and repeating that decision over and over and over again at the many intersections that our life will face, and we choose to surrender and we yield and we go God's way, there is a joy that comes with that because we experience a closeness to him. A satisfying connection with who God is that is worth whatever we thought we were getting out of our agenda. But it comes through surrender. And without surrender, the whole thing just seems, frankly, a little odd. Why would I sacrifice for others when I'm really living for myself? We feel that tension inside and the discontent that comes with that. Something's got to give. And what needs to give is within us. It's surrender. I love the way Paul uses these descriptions of this. He says in 2 Timothy 4, he says, I'm being poured out as a drink offering. Or in Romans 12, verse 1, present yourselves as a living and holy sacrifice. The language is really vivid and it's suggestive. And it says, okay, at the end of the day, who am I? I'm a sacrifice to the Lord. My life is a sacrifice to the Lord, which means that I'm yielding to Him. I'm saying, you know, this is your way. And however you want this to work out, however you want to use my life, I give you total access. Total access. And then we learn what some of that total access is, and we move back a little bit. I didn't really mean it, you know. And then he's like, well, okay, now we're at another place of decision. How about you trust me now? And we keep kind of going at this thing. But it's always in that place where we're saying, I just want my life to be poured out for the things of God. That's where we feel that deep, transforming experience of the life of Christ in us and through us. It's really awesome. And then he says in 1 Corinthians 6:20, he says, you've been bought with a price. That's what redemption means, to be bought out of our captivity, to ourselves, to our guilt. And he says, because of this, he says, glorify Christ with your body. You know, he's talking in this context about sexual morality. He's saying, you know, your life, your body, it's not your own. It's the Lord's body. To be bought out means that you're just on your own, but now you belong to the Lord. And when you choose then to glorify Him, which is to bring attention and worthiness and praise to Him, then now that tension between my way and His way is resolved. We've surrendered. We're reading off the same page. And we are able then to be shaped and molded as He desires. And something very beautiful awaits us as we continue down that path. So this is discipleship 101. This is the first lesson. This is the lesson of humility. And so with that, we'll just make the point that if we want to yield to God, it's not something that we just kind of go and decide. But it's something that we pursue Christ, you know, in prayer, and we pursue Him in His word. And we come to those moments of clarity and we say, God, I am all in. I get it. And it's as we have discipline in this area of our own personal study and in our prayer that it really fuels that surrender of our hearts to God. There's a need to fight against the things that are always competing for our hearts and minds. And the only way to remain yielded to the Lord is by pursuing Him in a real consistent way, having habits of Bible study, of prayer, things like that that connect us with God in an ongoing way. There you have it.
This study was recorded at Xenos Christian Fellowship and is copyrighted. You may freely copy and distribute it as long as you keep it intact and do not sell it.